Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Chicago Bullseye special episode today. We have an interview with Jim King, former NBA player, former All-Star. It was an honor to have him on the Chicago Bullseye podcast, and former Bull. Jim King, born February 7, 1941. He was a 6'2 guard from University of Tulsa, selected by the Los Angeles Lakers in the second round of the 6'3 NBA draft. So keep in mind, there were only nine teams in the league at that time, so he was a 13th overall pick. Second round, 1963. He played 10 NBA seasons from 63 to 73 with four teams. The Lakers, the San Francisco Warriors, Cincinnati Royals, and the Chicago Bulls. Played in several NBA finals with the Lakers versus the Celtics. Also played with the Warriors, I believe, in the finals against Chamberlain and the 76ers. And he also represented the Warriors in the 1968 NBA All-Star Game in Madison Square Garden. He retired with 4,377 career points. He later coached the Tulsa Golden Hurricane, his alma mater, from 75 to 1980. And the Golden Hurricane actually retired his number 24. Tulsa retired his number. So it was just great to have him on. He told some incredible stories, and it's just amazing to listen to him speak about the NBA during the 1960s and the non-guaranteed contracts and first-round picks getting cut on the first day of camp. And just the stories are phenomenal, and he shares a lot of great information about some of the great players that he played with on the Lakers, like Jerry West and Elgin Baylor. Talks about why the Celtics won so much in the 1960s. And in part two, which you'll hear later this week, you know, he'll talk about his time with the Bulls and that team, that beloved 1970-73 team. Jerry Sloan, Norm Van Leer, Bob Love, Chet Walker, the team that really first really captured the hearts of Chicago basketball fans. So I hope you enjoy this interview. Follow me at CBE Fred on Twitter, Chicago Bullseye Fred, CBE Fred, or shoot us an email at chicagobullseye@gmail.com. I hope you enjoy this interview. All the best. Enjoy. Talk to you soon.
Hi, Jim. It's Tim Gallagher along with Fred Pfeiffer.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing?
Doing great. It's an honor to talk with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be on.
A real pleasure to have you on with us, and it's going to be great to hear about your playing experiences in that 63 to 73 era. And I thought to get started, you could tell us a little bit about your experience of getting into the NBA, you know, getting drafted out of college, what your expectations were as a outstanding college player, and so how you were selected, how you found out about getting picked by the Lakers, and then maybe training camp and making the team. That would be great to hear your memories of that.
In those days, they did a draft, you know, they just did a conference call. There were only nine teams, and they did a conference call, and the press was not involved. So, you know, usually they announced who they the next day or something, and you'd hear that you got drafted. And I got a call from the Lakers the next day after the draft, and they said that they had taken me as they had two second draft picks, and they took me in that, in one of those picks. So I said, okay, so that means I was in the next nine, somewhere in the next nine drafts, I guess, or eight drafts.
So yeah, so only nine teams in the league when you came out of college. That's
right.
That's amazing. You know, it's triple that now. So there weren't that many spots, right, for any teams.
No, right. Lou Mose, who was the general manager of the Lakers at that time, who was a pretty he's an older gentleman, and he called me and said he was going to come in and meet with me and sign me to a contract. And I said, okay. So he came in, and I was engaged at that time to get married after I was hoping I could make the team to come back and get married, and after my first year, and she was with me, and so we met, and he said, I've got a contract for you for $9,500 and a $500 bonus.
So no agents or intermediaries. It was just you and the GM face to face.
That's right. Nobody else. And so I said, wow, $500, you know. So, you know, just to give you a perspective on this, I bought my wife an engagement ring for $130. You know, it wasn't a big one, but it was an engagement ring. And then I had a 55 Ford that had no air conditioning. I knew I was going to have to drive at night just to be cooler all the way out to L.A. And it was smoking. My wife's family there, she had two brothers, and they had a friend that his dad was a stock car driver, and he did a lot of the mechanics work. And he said, I'll overhaul that engine for you to stop that smoking for $100 and a quarter. when I said, "When can you do it?" And so there went half of my money right there. Yeah, my $500 bonus was half gone, and I still had enough to get to L.A. Buy gas. But you know, at those days, gas was about 21 cents a gallon. You know, so that was the start, and I actually had called him and asked him. I said, "Look, I'm going to be driving out. I'm going to drive at night, and I'd like for you to, if you don't mind, I'd like for you to let me come a couple of days early." And he just said, "No, you come when everybody else does." I said, "Okay, I'll catch up on maybe a night's rest or something, you know." But he said, "No, you get here on Sunday like everybody else." I said, "Oh," he said, "we treat everybody equal here." And I said, "Okay, that's okay with me. I'll be there." Charged on into next night. I got into Needles, and at Needles about 12 o'clock at night, 12:30, and I thought, "I'm gonna stop and eat breakfast, and then roll on in," you know. And so Needles, boy, it was like over 100 still at midnight out there. And so I walked into a Denny's, and I saw a L.A. Times laying there, and it said, and there was a sports page on top, and it said somebody had just thrown it there. It said Lakers to open camp, and I thought, "Oh my gosh." I got to read that. So I went over and sat down, placed my order, and started reading the article. And it said they were guessing on who was going to make the team out of the 8 guards that they had in the camp. So 3 of them had been picked up from other teams, and 5 of them were new recruits. And so they said, and by the way, I should have said this in the beginning, but when he offered me that contract, I said, "Well, I'd like a no-cut contract," because I'd heard about those. And he said, "We don't give no-cut contracts. The coach doesn't like them, and we don't like them. We think it's best to give everybody the same opportunity." And I said, "Okay, I'll buy that. You know, that sounds right. I'm okay with that." And he said, "All you have to do is you have to play some defense so Jerry West doesn't get in foul trouble. You're going to have to learn how to cover the big guys. You got to be able to bring the ball down the floor and give it up and move it, you know, get the ball moving, get the offense moving." And I said, "I can do all that. I can do it. And I'll cover whoever it is." And he said, "Okay, that's all you're going to have to do to make this team." Well, of course, you know, I knew I couldn't believe everything. But I look in, I'm reading that article, and it says, they're going to – that was the year of the Pan Am. It was 64 coming up in Pan Am. Actually, Pan American game was played, you know, the year before. This was 63, so they were playing, and one of the kids on the team that they had drafted was named Mel Gibson, not the actor, but he was from Western Carolina, a small college, a little All-American, and he was on that team, and he was kind of a standing jump shooter. But anyway, he was on the team, and they said he was going to make the team. They agreed that he was going to be the guy that makes the team because he had a no-cut contract. And I kind of chewed on that steering wheel the rest of the way in. You know,
so a little more motivation point, you know, coming across the desert and getting into L.A.
Yeah,
so tell us about when you got to camp.
Yeah, well, when I finally get in there, I walk in the motel, check in, and there's a guy standing there. It looks like, you know, a young guy, tall, 6'5" or so. And I said, "Hey, are you here with the Lakers?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Oh, I'm Jim King from Tulsa." And he said, "I'm Roger Strickland from Jacksonville." And he was the number one draft pick. And I said, "Oh, when'd you get in?" And he said, "I've been here 30 days working out the regular team." And I thought, he wouldn't let me come out 2 days early. And he's been there all month, you know, the month. So everything was equal, like you said. Everybody got an equal chance. You know, all they did was motivate me more. I went to my room. I got ready for practice the next morning. We got there at 8 o'clock, and there wasn't anybody there. I was there at 8 o'clock, and there's nobody there. And I thought, I'm at the wrong gym, and I worried about that. Well, you know, waited around for about 30 minutes. And practice was supposed to be at 10, and about 9 o'clock, finally, some guy drives up in the car and he gets out. Says, I look over and notices the door's locked, and he stands there. And I said, "Oh, are you with the Lakers?" And he said, "Yes, I am, son. I'm the coach." And I said, "Oh, well, I'm Jim King." I felt like nobody knew I was coming, you know, because he had obviously never seen me in a film or anything. I hadn't seen the looks or anything, you know. You would have thought he had known what I looked like. So I said, right. He said, "Oh, good to meet you, Jimmy. Glad to have you here." And I said, "Great, thanks." And so I just wanted to be the first one in and the first one on the floor and let him know I'm here to win this spot. And so we get in there and we start practicing. Finally, everybody gets there, and they, you know, everybody, some guys get taped, their ankles and all that, and we get out. But I'm out there shooting for 30 minutes before some of them even get there. And then they opened the windows. We're at Loyola, and the windows, there was no air conditioning. They opened the windows out there because, they let the air through there from the coast there. But it was a smog alert day, and the smog just rolled in. You could see it in the gym. It was so bad. And, I never smoked, but I played with it, a couple times as a kid. And I know what it can do to your lungs when you take a drag. And that's what it was like, when you take a slide. You couldn't get a deep breath. And Fred Schaus was a drills coach. He taught, he wanted to run drills and see how well schooled you were and how you could do things, through those drills. And I had an incredible high school coach that was a drill freak. And he made us do them. Everything had to go for full speed, and everything had to be left-handed and right-handed. If you couldn't do it that way, you went to the other end, practiced on your own until you learned how. And, that's the way it was. And my coaches at college was a little back. They were kind of alike. Both of them a little bit of IBA background. So anyway.
Mm-hmm. Hank IBA. Mm-hmm.
We go for an hour, and he blows a whistle. And first of all, people are running into each other. I mean, the drills, most of them had never been drills. I mean, seen that many drills or that kind of drills. And they're all my high school coaches' drills, every one of them. And he finally saw them after about 15 minutes of collisions and all kinds of losing basketballs and everything. He just said, "Jimmy, do you know how to do this drill?" And he mentioned it to me. I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, lead us out." And so from then on, I was like the leader running drills.
The first day of training camp.
First day of training camp. First hour. And then the whistle blows, and he says, "Okay, I want you to take 5 minutes to get a drink of water, and we're going to go back after it for another hour." And seven guys, hit the floor. There's actually six of them because, besides myself, because the number one draft pick had been there long enough to where they'd already, figured him out and knew that he had an attitude problem or something. And then he made one quick remark, and he's gone. I mean, it was absolutely – he said, "There's a door, there's a locker room, go turn your stuff in and get out of here." So then it went from eight to seven. Whenever he said that, six guys hit the floor, just laid down on the floor. I couldn't believe it, because I'd never had a coach who would let me sit down in practice, not only laid on the floor. It just didn't happen. And so I stood there for a second, and I was hurting like they were, but I just ran to the other end. I thought, I know I'm in better shape than these guys. And I ran down and picked up a ball, started doing some ball handling, and shot some free throws, and just kept going. I didn't get a drink. I was never allowed to do that. So I was prepared probably more than anybody mentally to do what – because I'd played against in Missouri Valley Conference at that time. Tulsa was in – at that time, Missouri Valley was the conference in the country, putting more players in than any – in the pros than any conference. And so, anyway, later on, they finally told me I'd made the team, Lou Mose called me in and said that we want to keep you, but we'd like for you to go ahead and move your marriage up so you don't get drafted in Vietnam was going on. And they're not drafting married guys, so if you don't mind, you can move it up. I said, "I can handle that. That's no problem at all." For a second, he says, you know when you made this team, don't you?" And I said, "No, I don't think so. I don't remember any one point." He said, "Do you remember the first day of practice?" I said, "Yes, sir." And they had the smog alert. I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You, whenever they blew the whistle, at halftime, to stop and get a drink and all, you just, you ran down to the other end of the floor by yourself?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I remember that." He said, "Well, your friend Jerry West was sitting with me and watching practice, and he told me right there, there's only one guy who can make us better. So it didn't hurt you." Saying you keep doing the right things, and the right things come back.
Did you see Jerry West there, Jim? Did you see him?
No, I didn't. No.
So you didn't even know he was there. I have to go back to this. The first round draft pick was basically kicked out of practice. Is that what you're saying? At the
first 15 minutes. Yes.
Can you imagine something like that happening today? Not in a million years.
It was really a blessing that they brought him in early because they figured him out. They got the understanding that he either had an attitude or he had, he was a little bit too slow to play guard. He could really shoot the ball, but he'd had a hard time getting the shot off because he just didn't have the quickness. But I think they really realized watching him work out there that he wasn't going to make it, and they just got one hand and got rid of him. So, but
sure.
It was a good thing for me, you know, to, for that to happen, even though when it happened and I found out he'd been there a month, I thought, that's not fair.
Jim, at that time, you know, we're talking about 63 to 66, you're playing for Lakers. I mean, the Lakers are the team in Los Angeles right now, the huge team. How were the Lakers at that period in Los Angeles? Were they bigger than the Dodgers? Were they bigger than the Rams? I mean, where were they relative-wise in the city? Were they popular? Could you give us kind of an idea about how they were viewed back then?
Well, I think the Lakers were so new. They came in there in like 60, I think, 60, 61. And that's when they went out there. I believe it was, or maybe it's 59. But I know they'd just been there a couple of years when I got there in 63. So, and West had only been there. You know, when West came out, when that's like the first year, and because Fred Shouse he was his coach in college at West Virginia, and he became the head coach at that time also. So I think it all, you know. So anyway, back to your question, they were very popular. I mean, people really embraced the team. And, you know, out there, if you went to college games, and I had a friend that was assistant coach at Tulsa and then went out and took Cerritos Junior College job and won the state and that a couple times. And then he came back here and coached at TCU for several years and had a great record. He was a good coach, great coach. But I used to go to his games and they'd have 50 people there. Nobody wanted to go inside for anything. You know, so the weather's always so good, they didn't really want to go to anything inside. But whenever the Lakers came out there, you know, West and Baylor were two of the, you know, they're at their prime right at that time. And they put on a good show. And then, of course, our big rivalry was Boston. And so Boston was winning everything. And we, you know, everybody just kind of, you know, got behind us and tried to get us over the hump there against Boston every year. And, of course, it didn't happen against Boston because Russell was there and he stopped all that mess, you know, along with the rest of them. But that was the thing. I think they were probably second or third. I think the Dodgers were ahead of them just because they'd been out there a little longer and they'd really created a big following. And they had, you know, Koufax and you know, that bunch was out there. So they were drawing great too. And the Rams weren't bad at that time, but I mean, they weren't, you know, they weren't winning big, but, they, you know, they were, they didn't stay that much longer. They ended up moving, but, I'd say the Lakers were number two behind Matt. I would just guess, behind the Dodgers, but they moved. I think they moved ahead, you know, fairly quickly after that. The West Baylor combo was such a clean image for people to follow. I mean, they just set a great example. They were good guys. They played hard. They practiced hard. You know, there was no negatives about them. They kept their nose clean, and you know, they're just good character. That was easy to follow. It was easy for me to follow those guys because of their, you know, their character.
Sure. Jim, I was going to ask you a little bit about you. We'll talk about West and Baylor, of course, but maybe first touch on Baylor. And obviously, you know, a core of the listenership here, a Chicago Bullseye or big Michael Jordan fans and, you know, Bulls fans. So, you know, Baylor, in my mind, was, you know, so far ahead of his time and, you know, so different in playing kind of above the rim, right, or had hang time before that word was probably even in the lexicon, right? Maybe talk a little bit about what a dramatic different athlete he was compared to most others in the NBA at that time.
Okay. You know, I didn't see Oscar when I was in college. When I was a freshman, he came into Tulsa because he was in the conference and saw him play at one time. And I thought, boy, that's the most dominant player I've ever seen with the ball. I mean, just take, you know, just control the ball and the tempo and could shoot wherever he wanted to shoot from and all that, you know, a lot of that kind of stuff. Then when I got to L.A., I mean, and Oscar was a great passer, too. That would impress me. When we got to L.A., Elgin did even more than Oscar did, I think. He had that tick-tock he did, you know, with his head that, you know, he had that nervous twitch with his neck and his head, you know. And Hot Rod Henley always called it a tick-tock. He called him tick-tock because of that. But he'd come down the floor and he had a head bobbing, you know, and And he could do so much with the ball. And one of the things he did the best is he was a great rebounder, so strong. But he'd take it out of a bunch of guys, big guys. He'd take the one hand, he'd yank it out of the air, and hit the floor, turned around facing the other end, and go with it right down the middle of the court and lead the break. And I'm telling you, you could not take your eye off of him, because he could pass it so hard, so well, that it hit you in the chest or hit you in the face, and you think, where'd that come from? You know, it happened in exhibition, and I realized then that you don't take your eye off him when you're running. You just run and hope nothing gets in front of you, because he's going to hit you with it, you know, if you're open. And so he was that way. Then the other thing I saw him do on the year he'd done, year before I got there, they had a highlight film, and I had it took it to my camp and showed the kids. And one of the things he did was you know how Russell used to get the rebound, and sometimes he'd walk to half court or walk to part of the way. He wouldn't run down on offense. That's the least of his worries, because he had all those guys could shoot, and so he wouldn't hurry down. But anyway, Elgin intercepted the pass about half court from somebody, and the only guy back was Russell, and so Bill just kind of got back into the lane, and I about wore that film out showing at this, because we counted. You know, he came down and his left foot left the floor on the free throw line, and so he went up with it, and being right handed, he went up, you know, like he's going to dunk it, and right in the middle of it, he pulled it over to his left hand, swung it over to the left side. And Bill went up in the air with his left arm, like ready to block it in the air. And then Els brings it back to his right hand, takes his left hand, and pushes his arm out of the way and slams it over him. he's 6'5". You know, he's not 6'7" or 8". He's 6'5". But he's so strong. And so when I saw him do that, I thought, my gosh. You know, the other thing he did that I've never seen anybody do was, he didn't like going to his left. He would enough sometimes to make you think he was going, kind of like Lenny Wilkins would never go to his right. But he'd go far enough to where you thought, okay, this time he's going, then he'd come back. Well, Elgin would be on the left-hand side facing the basket, and maybe he'd be going that towards that corner, and he would put reverse spin on it, so he would hit the backboard, and the ball would actually hit on the other side of the goal, but it would hit the backboard and come back, kind of like the guy golfers do, and it would come back that way. Because he had such big hands, he could put so much English on the ball, reverse English, you know, that it would hit the other side and go, and come back. And that was kind of an aha moment when I first saw him do that. I've never seen anybody do it, and I don't think I've ever seen anybody do it since then. Everybody's doing the other English, you know, from the right side. But
wow.
But he was an incredible player. He played... He created a lot of shots, but his percentages, field goal percentage, was never that great. Now, you know, he did play one game when he was playing in the service the year before I got there. He was in military time, and he could only play on the weekends, and it was during the playoffs, and I think he ended up with something like 69 in a game in Boston. So, you know, he could turn it on where you couldn't stop him. If he was on, you just had to say it's his day, you know.
Right.
But
great.
Great
hearing those Elgin stories.
That's fantastic. Yeah. How did he get along with Jerry West? I mean, you got two superstars like Elgin Baylor and Jerry West. Was there any clash of egos? Was there any clash, this is my team?
I roomed with both those guys quite a bit. I never heard a negative about each other. In fact, you know, I've never heard Jerry ever say anything about him other than praising. I mean, he's always defended him and said he's never gotten as much recognition as he should have. He's one of the greatest players that ever played the game. And, you know, they've always been really fans of each other. And, again, that's another one of those reasons why I think everybody wanted to follow him, and because they could tell they played together, they shared the ball. Even though Elgin could get the shot off down the stretch, I think even Elgin knew that nobody can hit the last shot like Jerry West. I always
Mr.
felt
Clutch.
Like he would win. Mr. Clutch, yeah. And I try to tell my grandsons, and they talk to him. They're always grilling me about these videos and all the stuff they see, you know. And they play these games with with us on there. You know, it's crazy, but I can't believe they didn't look like me when I. But you know, he came in. He said, "Papa King, you got to come in to see this." And I said, "Why?" He said, "I got you on my team." And he said, "You just did a reverse pivot and went down the." Slammed it over somebody. I said, "That's not me."
Well, you know, it's funny. Anyway, the technology now is really helping young people know some of the players from past eras. So you know, there is a plus in all that playing the video games, but
absolutely.
They're learning about players like you.
One of the things that I want to say, you know, Dick Barnett was there the first year I was there, and Frank Selvey was the other guard. Two were great pros. Dick was a left-handed shooter, you know, and he used to shoot that. He'd pull up, and that's before the three-pointer, but he'd pull up the top of the key, you know, on a three-on-one and shoot a 20-footer, you know, 25-footer. And he'd holler, "Fall back, baby." You know, you don't have to worry about it. Yeah, I used to hear him say that, "Fall back, baby." And I asked Fred Schaus, I said, and I was on a wing wide open, you know, going for a layup, and he pulls up and shoots that 30-footer, 25-footer, whatever it is. And I said, "Fred, do you think it's a percentage shot?" And he said, "Well, not for everybody, but it is for him." Now, today it makes more sense because he could get three for it, you know. But anyway, he used to come to the huddle at like the last quarter. We're down 10 points, let's say, and 10 or 12 points. And Dick Barnett would come in, and he had this real heavy, but slow talking voice. And he'd say, "Look at here. Let's just keep it close." And, you know, and I thought, yeah, we need to keep it close so we can win this thing. Well, that didn't mean that. It meant, and then we'll give the ball to Jerry the last 7 or 8 minutes, and he'll hit it every time we come down and we'll win this thing. And that's exactly what it meant, you know, and I figured that out watching all those games while I wasn't playing very much as a rookie. But, you know, that's when I realized that this guy's winning 25 games a year for us. By just taking over in the last, because nobody could stop him, and he just didn't miss. You know, he was just an incredible shooter under pressure, and he was such a competitor. He wanted everything to be right. You know, he was a perfectionist, and he shot the ball the same way every time, and he knew it would go in, and he didn't have to question about it. One experience we were playing in Boston, we seldom ever won in Boston. We're down to the 30 seconds, and we got a 6-point lead, and we're thinking, man, we're going to finally walk away with the field win. And then Sam and KC put on a hatchet kind of a defense and stole the ball a couple times and scored. And now with 3 seconds to go, they're ahead by one. 3 seconds, and we got the ball and timeout at half court, and we run a play. And Gene Wiley was our center. Gene was never a scorer, but he played at Wichita, big 6'11", and guy could get the tip. He could go straight up, and he wasn't a great athlete, but you know, he played center for us. And we said put Elgin over away from the basket. I mean, on the far side, and Jerry put Jerry out of bounds. And in fact, when we came into the huddle, I didn't think we'd ever get a play because everybody was just stunned that we lost this 6-point lead, and. And Fred was stunned. He just couldn't say anything. He was out down there in front of us, but he couldn't get anything out. And finally, Jerry says, "Fred, get me the damn ball." And and everybody said, "Yes." You know, we knew what we wanted to do. He knew, but so anyway, this is the play he set up. And he said, "Gene, you break to the top of the key up on the free throw line because Bill won't cover you up there. They know you're not going to shoot it." So he throws a high pass to him. He catches the ball, and Jerry steps – I mean, KC turns to see where it went. And Jerry broke to the corner, and he caught it, took one dribble, and shot it. And, of course, the ball's in the air when the buzzer goes off. And I'm looking for him. I look up for see where he is, and he's already run off to the end of the court headed for the dressing room. That's how assured he was it was going in. He was so mad. He was so – his eyes were just literally dilating over there in the huddle. I thought, oh my gosh, he's gonna kill somebody.
Was that a finals game, Jim?
It wasn't a playoff. It wasn't even a playoff game. It was a game during the year. We just caught him at the right time.
What was it about that Celtics team that you know allowed them to win? In your opinion, after you know playing them firsthand, what was it that made them so good to continually win titles like that?
Well, they quit winning when Bill quit playing. You know, so that was a pretty
Bill Russell.
Bill Russell was the biggest reason. Now,
The other reason was you had Red Auerbach coaching, and Red was a great coach. He did a great job of conditioning. And, you know, I always felt like we were never in as good a shape as we should have been when I was with the Lakers, because I thought, because Jerry and Fred just said, well, they'll be in shape within the first couple of weeks of the season. Well, but a couple of weeks of the season, you've already played five or six games, so you don't want to get a slow start, you know. But it was not unusual to see Boston race out to a 20-0 start, go out there and win the first 20 ball games, because he had them in so good a shape. Great shape. I mean, they're running your death, you know. And so they played great defense. They didn't play, they did press the whole time. But the whole secret was to put pressure on the offense, not to try to trap them, not try to steal it, but just be there if they make a mistake. And you know all the time there's pressure on you if your defensive man is covering you, and make them change directions about three times before they get across half court. You know, that was the whole press. That was the only pressure. And invariably, you get a little tired, and you get to a point where you might kick it out of bounds, or you might mishandle it, and they're right there. They get it. But the other thing is, like I told Tim yesterday, we were visiting about Sherman, and, you know, Sherman had that same philosophy when I played for him in San Francisco. He said, if we run off three streaks of 8 or 10 points without them scoring, we'll never lose. But if we run off just one, we'll get beat some. So two times, he said, most of the time you'll win. Three times you'll never lose. And so that was, again, I have a feeling that came from the Boston philosophy, that you kept the pressure on offensively and defensively, and you ran. And another thing is, you never knew how to cover, never who was going to be high point man for them. So they wanted everybody to score, and they shared the ball. They first moved the ball down. Like Bill, I got an old video from Al Addles when I went out there about 10 years ago and got a game. I just wanted to see how we played, because when I was up there with Rick Barry and Nate Thurman, which was a lot like Celtics did, and basically we didn't dribble. You know, you got so many people dribbling the ball today that it takes, you know, one guy knows where he's going. Maybe he doesn't even know where he's going, but, you know, it stops the momentum. And Bill wanted you to pass the ball down. If somebody already down the floor, pass it down. Then he wanted guys to run to spots, crisscross under the basket, and try to create a mismatch where a big guy's got a little guy covering him, and before the big guy's defense gets down. You know, he had all these different ways of setting up odd man situations, and it created havoc for the defense, and gave us a lot of opportunities. That the other thing was, just he used to say, "Run it." I used to hear his voice, "Run it down, Jimmy." We'd have a timeout, and we'd take it out on the other end of the floor. You know, and I'd think, okay, we can just kind of take it down and slowly, and you set this play up. He'd say, "Run it down, Jimmy." And what he said, he would tell me, he'd say, "Look, there's going to be somebody walking down there defensively with their back turned, and you can part their hair with it, and we can get a layup. We don't have to run a play, you know, if you're just alert. In other words, you're attack, 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 attack." Mm. And that's the same philosophy, I think, that San Francisco has now. They run those streaks off when you think that, okay, they're going to get conservative here and hold the ball. They got like a six-point lead, or a four-point, and then this four-point lead. And you think, there's three minutes to go. Man, they better just hang on to it now. Well, you can't with a 24-second clock. So, you know, they're looking for a break, and all of a sudden they run nine off on you. Now you're down 10 or 12, and it's a minute and a half to go. I mean that's what they're looking for, is those streaks where they can just just hit you so fast you don't know what's happening.
Right.
It makes you panic a little bit, and then you'll throw it away again. So I think that's why they were so great. They just had the offense and the defensive covered. They all played hard. There's nobody, there's no prima donnas on the team. There's no stars. Of course, I used to hear them talk about during the playoffs, if Russell would get so uptight, you know, getting ready to play, that he'd go in the shower and throw up. And when he'd do that, he'd look around, everybody'd raise their fist and say, "Yes! If Big Bill's ready, everybody's ready." You know, he dominates. And he was amazing. He was, you know, he wouldn't just block your shot. He'd knock it out to one of the guys that's going the other way. He didn't slap it. You never saw him slap it in the stands. That wasn't what he was up there for. He was knocking it out. He'd go up and just with his wrist, flip it out to somebody was on a green uniform, you know. he was way ahead of anybody that's ever gotten in this league with defense. I mean, he thought it. He was a cobra. He was a killer. Instinct. He was a killer. You know, he played to win every game. And I always felt like their philosophy was you win. If you get them down by 20, your next goal is to get them down by 40. You know, because they beat people, at least blow them completely out. And, you know, it's a killer instinct. You got to have that. You never, you know, you kill, like he said, you kill an ant with a sledgehammer.